began to set out the whole normalization scenario. Was that cabled to you? That went to the president. I think that was the last time that that Stape and Harry and Al Romberg were included in thinking about China policy. Then the paper went to the president with a covering note from Brzezinski in late May, after his big got back. I guess it would have been late May, early June. And as I recall, our commitment was that you would be seeking your first appointment in June. That was the indication
at the
end of June.
That's correct.
We then began to, we had a meeting I did not have a meeting with, there was a Brzezinski meeting, advance meeting with Carter, which Dick Holbrooke and I then received our debriefing on. I have the notes from that particular meeting, one of the few that I have notes from, which President Carter said that he would like to normalize by December 15th. No one remembered that date afterward, but that was the date he said. And it wasn't until I saw my notes when I was clearing my desk in my safe in Washington that I came across that. And then the president said that he wanted Dick, myself, to be involved. We then included Herb Hansel later on. And he wrote in the memo.
Legal counsel.
Yes, the legal counsel. He wrote a note saying, "This is to be kept absolutely secret. I do not trust the State Department. I do not trust the press. I do not trust Congress. I do not trust the White House staff." That was a great one. This is only to be known by three people. But that was his mind, his framework at that point, because he had begun to suffer from leaks on the Iranian situation already. And those annoyed him greatly. And we then began to draft our first set of instructions. Now, then we set up our special channel with you, right, so that we began to send that, your first set of instructions, directly to you.
Do you remember when that happened?
You did not get those until very late, because we kept saying, but Leonard has a June date. Oh.
The fact that we were going to do it was known, though.
Was known.
Right.
But then we had a somewhat similar situation to the situation that you encountered the previous October. We could not. Dick was to do some of the writing, as I recall, and then he was going to bring it over, and I wasn't going to press too hard on exactly where the paper came from or anything. That's a very vague recollection I have in my mind. And the week drew on, and 2 weeks drew on, and where was the first set of talking points? We couldn't get them, and so we eventually said, this is going to be embarrassing. We said we would be in June, and finally it was set up for July. But as I recall, you got your first set of instructions very late, and they were rather crude. That is to say, they didn't say very much. All they set forth was how we intended to negotiate.
Point by point.
That's right. And we wanted the first session of yours was just simply a statement of how we would proceed. And then from there it began to loosen up. But it was hard to get that. And that was the reason that eventually, because of the difficulty of getting the first set of papers, that I then began to handle all the drafting of your instructions. And then we sent you, I believe, from then on, we sent you a draft of what we intended your instructions to be to get your comments.
Right, that's true.
But the first time we did not do that. As I recall,
I think that's correct. Right. Of course, the first one was more procedural than substantive.
It was a procedural presentation.
which was not very well received when we get to that. Well, the Fraser group, along with us, then went to Shanghai. Two things stick out there. We went out to visit a vegetable commune, and as we're driving back, Doug said to our guide, "Did the Cultural Revolution have any personal effect upon you?" And the man got very emotional, with tears coming down his cheeks, remembering how he was still quite young. And the vegetable communes, one of which we had come around Shanghai, so many of them were growing grain in accordance with the instructions, grow grain, dig tunnels deep, etc. And his mother would have to get up at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning to go out to try and find some vegetables for the family to eat. And that was his personal reaction, and he was so... It was the first time I ever saw a Chinese who was emotionally reactive to this, and not simply reciting a line, which we were still getting at that time. Then too, you began to see, we went to a silk factory in Hangzhou, and the noise of the looms was almost deafening. We had two guides. We had a younger one along with the Frasers and Sharon and myself. And we said, doesn't this have an effect upon the workers' hearing? And he said, well, it's a very troublesome problem. And we're trying to find ways to overcome it. Well, can't they have stops in their ears? No, they can't, because they have to listen. They tell about coming difficulties by the noise of the looms. A trained operator can sense by the noise, the changes in the noise levels or vibrancies, that something has to be done. But we are working on it. The same question, as so happened, was asked by the rest of the party, of their guide, who was an older man, who said, "Oh, the workers love it. It's very, very good for them." That's the way he handled it.
That silk mill, of course, was a center of conflict during the Cultural Revolution.
Was it?
It was a stronghold of the leftists. It was eventually shut down for a while.
And then I'd asked it. When we were back in Peking, I'd previously asked to visit the Jeep factory, and I'd asked once or twice. It was inconvenient. We asked again, and could we go out there? They had an assembly line, but it was stationary, except every 9 minutes it moved. But the thing that I remember most is we were walking down the aisle, and we come up to a punch press, a 1930s type punch press, designed for a single operator, where you put the piece in at arm level when you're, less than arm level if you're standing up. But then you have to reach up to push the button to actuate the machine deliberately high up so that the hands are clearly have to be removed from the die. The Chinese had three running that machine, one in the front putting the piece under the die, one on the other side taking the piece after it had been stamped, pulling it out, and the third one pushing the button. And he's watching us come down the aisle, and he pushes the button every once in a while. He doesn't look down to see where the hands are. And I remember saying to the manager, "Don't you, do you have many accidents in this plant?" "Oh, no, no, no. They had absolutely, no accidents." Now, shortly after that, American Motors, who have, of course, the Jeep division in Toledo, began to negotiate with the Chinese for a contract to modernize that operation. And I thought they had concluded a contract before I left in late 1980. But just 3 weeks ago, I got a call from a person in AMC management who happens to live here in Ann Arbor to say he has now been put in charge of the Chinese negotiations, and he was leaving for China in a week or two. And I said, are those negotiations still going on? And they are, that nothing is, I said, I thought they'd been concluded. He said, so did we, but they never have. Interestingly enough, he is the first person from AMC who ever contacted me. Most of the companies coming to China would contact us, but for some reason they never did.
Well, I Tony Kane, who is at the Center for Chinese Studies, has been hired to be their interpreter, and I just had lunch with him.
Yes, sir. And it was during this time, too, that Henry Ford came. I see we had a reception for him on the 19th of June. That's when I took him on the side and had a very serious discussion with him about Taiwan. Opinion that I said, obviously I don't know, I can't guarantee it, but I am absolutely convinced that all common sense says that if we normalize relations here, we can have a situation where Taiwan can continue to prosper, and foreign investment can continue, and we had a very good conversation, and apparently it took effect because he left to go to Tokyo, and then from Tokyo to Taiwan, and in Taiwan he made a public statement that if normalization should take place between the mainland and the United States, he wanted people in Taiwan to know that Ford was there to stay. And because it is the dinner he gave, in which Li Qiang, the Minister of Foreign Trade, Mr. Ford calls across the table to me, Leonard, he said, Minister, can't understand how you and I are friends even though you shut me down for 120 days. Well, it wasn't 120 days, it was only 28, it may have seemed like 120 to him. But I said, just tell him contradictions. And it was at that time, too, that I, for the first time, met Jack Service and his wife. I don't know whether that wasn't their first trip back to China.
No, he went back in 71 already. This was perhaps one of his most nostalgic returns. I think he's been back two or three times, but this was,
yeah,
I think,
was
the
there.
One that he went back to his family place in Sichuan.
Yes. Then the next, he came back again very soon after that, when he went to Tibet. He had some other friends of mine, whose names I can't place at the minute, were coming with him, and the Chinese would not let him take his friends to Tibet. There was a party of six. They said he and his wife could go, but in 78 they were still...
I'm surprised they were willing to let Jack go in light of his very severe heart attack of a couple of years ago.
Well, I think their willingness to let you go is dependent upon you surviving the physical that they insist on giving him.
And he passed it.
He must have, because he went.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Then on the same day that the Fraser party left, on June the 23rd, State Roy arrived, and I must say that one of the best things I did was choosing State to be the deputy, because he was He was worth his weight in gold through the whole period.
Now, when did David Dean leave, though? He had left sometime earlier.
No. David was still there, and...
Is that right?
He left when he and Mary left on the Trans-Siberian 5 days later.
So David was there on Zvig's trip. I'd forgotten that.
Yes. Well, David used to be very self-effacing in these. He was every inch the diplomat in that bureaucrat, maybe I should say, in that regard.
Yeah.
Always there to do something if needed, but not at all obvious or pushing in any way.
Not an intrusive individual.
No. I found David Dean most useful to me.
But let me just pursue that for a minute. I haven't understood the full role of the DCM. Would you think that the normalization negotiations might have been different in some way or another if David had been there rather than Stape? And in what way would they have been different? I've never thought of that question before. I have always felt Stape contributed enormously, but it's...
David was strongly for normalization.
Yeah.
In fact, every once in a while he would... walk into my office and shut the door and convince me all over again we had to normalize while he was carrying coals to Newcastle, but he was just venting his own frustrations. It's hard to put into words, but knowing what we're going into, I was very happy to see Stape come.
Yeah.
It was a question of chemistry, I guess. I tend to be optimistic. All my life I've been lucky, so mostly my optimism is justified. Stape is very pessimistic. And so as we sat to talk about things, he would always assume the worst and I would always assume the best. And it made for sometimes happy conclusions. But for example, the meeting of December 15th, when I went down with such great apprehension, and when my apprehension was really fired by Dung immediately saying, "We will not agree, we absolutely cannot agree," thinking he meant everything. And then I really sweated through that hour. And when Dung suddenly stops and says, "Well, what shall we do?" And I respond, he says, "Okay." We stood up and shook hands. We walk out and go walk down the steps, get in the car, and I Stape is in there too, and I said, "My God, I thought for a while it was all over." Oh, he says, "I think it still may be." I looked at him with my mouth open and said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I don't think Washington's going to buy it." I said, What in hell do you mean? It's exactly where we were. But he and I got along amazingly well.
Well, he's an extraordinary person. I was the right man for the job, there's no doubt. Well trained, he is. His qualities, in part, I think, are due to Bill Gleistein's training too. He's got. I think of him somehow as reflective of Bill's nurturing.
I'm sure they had a great influence, a good effect on him.
Bill, I think Bill has done that with several in the Foreign Service that they think of as his. His legacy.
And I note that on the late in June we received just five leaders of the Chinese Performing Arts Group prior to their leaving for the U.S. There were actually 200 members of the, mm-hmm. of the group. And when they came back, they came back through Hong Kong and took the train from Guangzhou to Peking. walking, and I went to the train station to greet them, along with Long John. And then we had a reception for them, but the whole group of 200 came. And I had never seen some of these performing Chinese performers before, except on the stage or close up on the stage with all of their makeup on. I must say I was not shocked exactly, but somewhat surprised to see some of those faces, because some of them were older women, and their faces seemed to be more careworn than Chinese women of equivalent age, whether it was a result of all of that makeup constantly being applied or not, I don't know. But
now, at this point, we were planning for the Frank Press trip, weren't we? Or we were waiting for the response.
Well, I know, by the way, we were talking about the... I note that on the 27th of June, I stopped by the Yemen Arab Republic embassy to sign the condolence book for their murdered president. So it had taken place after
Zbig. Date for the Frank Press trip was set in late June. I had told Zbig that I thought that the Chinese would not take him so quickly. Zbig said they'll take him right away, and that they will want to get him before, well, the issue was, you'll remember that Frank Press was going to go to the Soviet Union. And and this big bet that they would get Frank there before he went to Moscow, and I bet that they would have him go to Moscow first and then come to China. But they just put it in before, and then of course the Sakharov affair blew up, and Frank Press never went to the Soviet Union.
That blew up while we
were there.
Right. Then I know my first 4th of July was in 1978 in China, and following what had been done before, we had two receptions. We had a noon reception for Chinese, and then we had an evening reception for the diplomatic community, the Yuslow family, and American tourists. Of course, American tourists seem to assume that on the 4th of July that they can come to the embassy and have a drink at no matter what time of day it is. And I noticed that it lasted from 6 to 8:15. It had been scheduled for the normal 6 to 7, as I remember it. In fact, we finally had to go around turning out the lights. One of the very last to leave was Robert Winters, who had been in China since 1922. And it was at the noon reception, which was from 11 to 12, that Wang Jun came. He was the ranking Chinese. I don't think Wang Hua came to that reception. And that's when he said to me, when we read about your speech in February, we thought that you were speaking out of turn and that you wouldn't be here very long. We now know, he said, that you obviously were speaking with the very highest of authority.
You mentioned in class yesterday that all but one of the members of the staff were for normalization. Who was not?
John Tassick, because his father lives in Taiwan.
I don't remember him.
He was the consul.
Uh-huh.
Consular officer. He did nothing. He didn't even argue. I doubt if he would even have told me. But in this period, after as big had been, and when I knew we were going to push forward, I took each of the senior officers one by one down in the conference room, the secret place, to discuss with them should we push ahead, how could we handle it, what did they think, and so on. If I hadn't asked him that question, I don't think he would have ever volunteered it. No, he didn't think so. Why didn't he think so? Well, he says, I have a personal involvement. He's worried about the reactions in Taiwan, his father, and in the event, there was absolutely no problem with John. Mm-hmm. On the morning of the 16th, when we had the whole staff together, and I told them what had happened, we had one very emotional reaction. One of the wives, who was born in Taiwan and whose family was there, just broke out sobbing and left the room, but she recovered fairly quickly. But everyone else was very supportive. Well, we're just on the eve of the
Frank Press.
The first session with Wong Wah on the Frank Press visit, same day as Codell Wolfe. So
I didn't remember that. Codell Wolfe was there also?
Yes.
Did we see him?
No, he was in the Peking Hotel.
Huh.
I, well, we can talk about that at the time.